Paul asked Josie. He turned to Anna. Did you turn all the knobs on the stove? Anna looked at her knees. Anna, that's really bad, he said. This was, Josie knew, the worst thing he'd ever said to her. Anna's chin shook and she began to cry, and Josie stood, satisfied. She wanted Anna to cry for once, to feel remorse for once. Anna's nickname for most of last year was sorry, given how often she had to say the word, but this had almost no effect on her tendency to put herself and her family in grave danger. This is a kind of life, Josie thought. She stood, looking around, noticing now that they had parked next to a beautiful round lake, the surface so clean and placid that the sky was reflected in it, in perfect symmetry. Looking at it, Josie felt a certain calm as she cycled through some questions and observations. She wondered how close to death they'd actually been. Could they have all died at mid-morning on a sunny Alaskan day? She wondered, with some seriousness, if Anna was an emissary from another realm, disguised as a child, but tasked with the murder of Josie and Paul. She wondered how long they needed before the chateau was clear of deadly fumes. She wondered what a life was, if this was a life. Was this a life? And she wondered about the gene she possessed, some strangling DNA thread that told her daily that she was not where she should be. In college, she changed her major every semester. First psychology, then international studies, then art history, then political science, and all the while she was on campus, she wanted to be away, away from the pedestrian workaday nonsense of most of her classes and the directionless pathos of most of her peers. She went to Panama and felt briefly vital, but then tired of shitting in a hole and sleeping under a net and wanted to be in London. In London, she wanted to be in Oregon. In Oregon, she wanted to be in Ohio. And in Ohio, she was sure she needed to be here, in Alaska. And now, she wanted to be where? Where, for fuck's sake? For starters, somewhere high above all this filth and calamity. Mom, take my picture. It was Anna. Her pants were around her ankles, her hands outstretched, as if ready to catch a falling man. Josie took her picture. They made it to Homer. It was only 1 o'clock. Josie pulled into the Cliffside RV park and paid $65 for the night, and then they headed out again, down the road, toward the Spit. Or the Spit. It was where most of the action in Homer was, Sam had said. So Josie descended from the hills and down the two-lane road onto the narrow promontory jutting into Kachemak Bay. Sure, it was pretty, Josie thought, without being Seward. For Josie, nothing had compared to Seward. Maybe the closeness of those mountains, the hard mirror of that bay, the icebergs like lost ships. Charlie. On the Spit's main drag, there were some old buildings that had real or former fishing operations in them, and there was a stretch of stores and restaurants. So realizing they hadn't eaten, Josie parked the chateau next to another, far more luxurious recreational vehicle, knowing this would make its owners happy to know they were better than her children. Josie ducked under the sink, pulled a handful of 20s from the velvet bag, and they left. She took Paul and Anna by their hands and crossed traffic, heading for a pizza restaurant that looked, from the outside, as though it had been made from broken ships. The exterior was a mess of bent walls and masts and crooked windows, everything blue-gray, like driftwood. The door was covered in stickers denying entry to those without shoes, with dogs, to unaccompanied children, to smokers and Republicans. Under that last admonition were the words, "Just kidding," and under that, "Not really." Inside, it was light-filled and warm and staffed exclusively by women. It seemed to be some kind of political pizza place, a pizza restaurant embodying its version of utopia. There was a giant stone oven in the middle of the first floor, and five or so young women buzzed about it, all in white aprons and blue shirts, all with short hair or ponytails. Josie ordered a pizza, afraid to look at the price, and the woman behind the counter, with a pixie cut and exhausted eyes, told her to sit upstairs anywhere. The second floor was bright, glassed in, and overlooking the Sound. The sun was so hot there that they all took off their jackets and long-sleeved shirts and were still warm in their short sleeves. Anna asked if she could have a knife, and Josie said no. Paul tried to explain to his sister why knives were dangerous, but Anna had already gone to the bathroom, and in seconds there was the sound of something falling. She returned to the table, saying nothing. "Can you check the bathroom?" Josie asked Paul, and he leapt up, knowing he was on a mission that combined his dual loves, checking after his sister and pointing out the wrongness of someone else's behavior. He returned. "Looks pretty bad," he said, and turned to Anna. Anna wasn't listening. She had caught sight of a motorboat cutting across the bay. Josie stepped into the bathroom and found a towel rack on the ground, knowing Anna had made it this way, and knowing that only Anna could have separated the towel rack from the wall this quickly. Hundreds, if not thousands, of customers had no doubt used this bathroom and this rack without breaking it, but Anna had done so in less than 90 seconds. The political pizza place had had an intoxicating effect on her already, for Josie found herself not caring about the towel rack. In fact, she was briefly stunned, undeniably impressed, that this girl had that acute a sense for the weakness of objects, that she could enter any room, any bathroom in Homer, and know the object most likely to be broken and just how to go about it. She went down and told one of the women that one of her kids had broken the towel rack. "How'd he do it?" the woman said. A different woman, with feathered earrings, was pulling something from the oven. "It was my daughter," Josie said. And now Josie knew she wouldn't have to pay for the damage. Her leverage was invisible, but real. "Just leave it up there," the woman said. "We'll get it." Josie ordered a glass of Chardonnay and two milks. Upstairs, it was 2 p.m., but felt like sunrise. The light on the water was tap dancing wildly, trying too hard, really, and there was some boat out there they were watching, some great yacht with 1,000 white sails. Josie finished her Chardonnay, and when one of the political pizza women, a third, with a sheep's black curls all over her big head, brought the food up, a lumpy pizza served on what appeared to be a piece of bark, Josie ordered another glass. This was why people linger. Sometimes a place asks you to stay, to not rush anywhere, that it's warm, and there's the tap-dancing water and the powder-blue sky, and they had the second floor to themselves. Josie felt that if anyone else came up there, she would drive them away, she would throw a knife. This was now their home. Soon, Anna was standing on the floor, using her chair as her table, eating her slice with her elbows on the seat. She was a disgusting shark child, but Josie loved her monumentally at that moment. Her never-questioning confidence in herself, in how her limbs should work, made clear she would always do things her way and never wonder if it was the right way. This meant she could be president and certainly would always be happy. She wiped her mouth on her arm like a feasting barbarian, and Josie smiled at her and winked. The sun swished around in the gold in her glass, and it sang a song of tomorrow. Josie drank it down. The kids ate two slices each, and Josie had two, and then wanted more wine. She asked the kids if they wanted anything. They didn't, but she convinced them they wanted some of the cookies she saw in a jar on the counter downstairs. Then she convinced Paul it would be great fun if they wrote an order down on paper, and if he brought it down to the political pizza women. Josie didn't want to see their eyes or puckered mouths when they heard her order a third Chardonnay at 3 p.m. on a Monday. And besides, Paul was at a stage where he liked to be entrusted with making a phone call, with punching in ATM codes, with running into the 7-Eleven himself. He knew it would be a decade before Anna would be allowed to do this kind of thing. He knew he was responsible, and he liked proving it. She wrote out the order. One milk, two cookies, one Chardonnay, and the check. And Paul took it downstairs. He He returned a few minutes later with another bark plate, all the items balanced on top. He was struggling a bit, and Josie thought for a fleeting second that she could get up and help him, but would he really want that? She stayed put. He made it to the table and looked at her with a terror that seemed to question whether or not his parent really knew what she was doing. To put him at ease, Josie smiled benevolently, like a grandma saint. She wanted to toast him and briefly raised her glass, but thought the better of it. "Look at that new ship," she said, before turning toward the bay and realizing it was the same one she'd seen before. The Chardonnay ennobled her, made her stupid. Her tongue grew and could no longer form words. She didn't want her children hearing her slur in the afternoon, so she said she was resting her eyes to soak in the warmth of the sun, and she raised her face to the streaked glass ceiling. Josie saw Jeremy's face, then her father's, and heard her father, in his white nurse's uniform, joking about sticking his head in the oven. Josie opened her eyes and saw Paul and Anna standing, his face near the back window, watching a pair of dogs humping in the dunes. After Carl, she'd alternated between complete indifference to any carnal pursuits. She had no urges, no drive, made no plans, could muster nothing approaching an effort. And then, once every 6 weeks, there would be a calling within her, something like possession, and she would be in heat. She occasionally slept with Tyler, a high school boyfriend. No, not a boyfriend. Someone she'd known glancingly in high school, and with whom, through the miracle of internet nostalgia sex, she had reunited. He'd written to her one day, attached a photo of her in her Halloween costume. She'd gone as Sally Bowles from Cabaret after her unsuccessful audition. "I defy thy verdict, Ms. Finesta." She recalled the feel of the tight satin on her legs in the cool night, the silver wig, and remembered her many admirers that evening and in the days after. A pair of satin tights, a black vest, and the imaginations of hundreds of boys were alive for decades. So Tyler refound some picture, called, said he was in town, passing through. Okay, fine. They ate pasta, drank numbing red wine, and later, in his hotel, he did a fine job with his small cock until he became determined to stick his finger in her ass. He tried it once, and Josie moved herself in a discouraging way. 5 minutes later, he tried again, and this time she gently pushed his hand away, assuming the matter settled. He tried once more, though, 5 minutes later, and this time she tried to make it funny, laughing a bit, as she said, "Why are you so hell-bent on sticking your finger in my ass?" But despite her caution and obvious decorum, he pulled away, pulled himself out of her, no great loss, and then, this part was delightful, he smelled his finger. Very slowly, very discreetly, as if he was just scratching his nose. He even looked away when he did it, out the window, as if hoping he'd gotten at least a little bit of her feces on his forefinger before she'd thwarted him. That was why he'd been sticking his finger in there, to smell the finger afterward. He was memorable. And there was the other man, the one who died. The last man she'd slept with had died a few weeks later. How did she feel about this? Vincent. He had been a kind man. A kind man who had said he would never leave her. For the children, he'd said. And she had appreciated this, his grave seriousness about not damaging her children in any way by entering and exiting their lives. For he knew about their father, Carl's powers of invisibility. "I won't leave you," he said. "I won't do that to your kids," he said. Never mind that he barely knew them, and they couldn't pick him out of a lineup. It was too soon. She understood he meant well, but after 2 months of seeing each other, he had said that if they were ever to break up, it would have to be her doing it. He could not abandon her. He would be in it for the long haul. She was flattered, maybe even impressed, but it was a bit constraining, no? She asked her friends, "This is constraining, yes? To be told that this man would be attached to you for the sake of the children he does not really know for eternity." He had a habit of watching her as she watched movies. He caught her tearing up during an Iraq War soldier widow movie, and after that, every time there was an emotional scene of any kind on the screen before him, he turned to her. She could always sense, in the dark, his face angling toward her to see if she was crying, or about to cry, or welling up. To what end? What internal score sheet was he keeping? He didn't carry a handkerchief and never offered her a tissue, but he'd been indoctrinated. Stay with woman for sake of children. Watch woman and her displays of emotion. Come to Normandy with me, he said once. The kids, too. I want you all to see something. He wouldn't tell her why he wanted to go to Normandy. He thought it would be some wonderful surprise. She explained the difficulty in leaving her practice and trapping her small children for 14 hours on two planes, all without knowing why they'd be going to that French beach. Finally, he told her. He'd been learning more about an uncle. No, a great uncle, he corrected himself the next day, apparently after some phone calls to his Salt Lake genealogists, who had fought and died on D-Day. He wanted to go, pay his respects, and apparently, because he'd decided whatever was hers, he wanted to share it all, the field of graves, with Josie. She'd suggested a few weeks away from each other, and he'd nodded, agreeing, praising her wisdom, and then, 2 weeks later, he'd died. He'd collapsed on the beach, at Normandy. He'd gone to lay flowers at the grave of his great uncle. Then, apparently after that, he'd gone jogging and suffered a venous thromboembolism. The funeral, back in Ohio, was a mess of ex-girlfriends and sisters. The man had a life full of women, and they had all loved him, so why hadn't Josie tried harder? The check from the political pizza makers arrived. They wanted $82. With a tip, she would be paying $100 for a pizza, two cookies, and three glasses of wine. This was Alaska. It looked like a cold Kentucky, but its prices were Tokyo 1988. Josie paid and walked down the steps, out the door, and felt so free out in the open and happy that the women of pizza hadn't seen her, drunken afternoon mother. Then she felt the afternoon's new chill and looked at her children and realized they didn't have coats on. Where were their coats? Josie turned around to find one of the women of pizza standing at the door, holding their coats and long-sleeved shirts, smiling like she could have Josie imprisoned. Josie took the coats, hustled Paul and then Anna into them, and they wandered down the street. Three shops down was a kiosk full of hand-woven hats and sweaters, and Josie was sure she'd never seen such beautiful things. Were these made here? Josie asked the woman, gray-haired and with bright opal eyes. The woman was grinning with joy, barely contained, as if to be in Homer selling handicrafts was more than she deserved. No, the woman said. Bolivia, mostly. She purred the live portion of the nation's name, implying this was the only place or way to do it, to live, and it seemed to Josie the only way to say the word. Josie fondled the sweaters and hats, thinking she must purchase these Bolivian goods in Alaska, and if she didn't, she would have missed an opportunity to fully seize this moment.
You let me know if you have any questions, the woman said,
and sat on a nearby stool, raising her face to the sun with a beatific smile. Josie found a scarf, wrapped it around Paul's neck, and stood back to admire him. He looked 5 years older, so she took it off.
Mom, how do you know Sam again? Paul asked.
This was unusual for him. Normally, she didn't have to tell him anything twice. His memory was airtight for unusual information about the adults in his life. Before she could explain, this time more memorably, he asked,
Have I met her?
He had met her, or Sam had met him, held him as a baby. Josie told Paul this and made up something about how he had really bonded with her, that she was sort of a godmother to him.
So she's my godmother? He asked.
Josie looked quickly to the opal-eyed woman, expecting judgment, but her ecstatic expression hadn't changed. The truth was that Josie hadn't given Paul godparents yet. When he was born, she held off,
wanting to wait till his personality had formed to better match him to the right people. It had seemed radically enlightened at the time, but since then she'd plainly neglected the task. Now this notion of Sam seemed inevitable.
Sure, Josie said.
Anyone would be better than Anna's godparents, friends of Carl's, who received the honor like a bad wedding gift quickly shelved. Anna hadn't seen anything from them, never a card, nothing. Sam, well, it could go either way. She would not likely be a smothering sort of godmother, but perhaps she could be the distantly inspiring sort. She could ask Sam about it when they saw her. No one ever said no to being a godmother, so it was as good as done. Sam's the best, she added. Did I tell you she had a crossbow? Sam wasn't the best, and she was only guessing about the crossbow, but Josie was overcome with a sudden longing to see Sam and to strengthen their ties over this godmother notion. She did love Sam in a complicated way and hadn't seen her in 5 years, and they'd walked the same strange path, and above it all, and most important for Josie this day, Sam was an adult. Besides Stan and Magic Show Charlie, Josie hadn't said more than please and thank you to anyone over 8 years old since they'd been in Alaska.
She's your stepsister? Paul asked.
This was true in a general sense. Telling the whole truth of their sisterhood wasn't possible, not to an 8-year-old. Though she'd tried, Josie hadn't arrived at a simple enough storyline to explain Sam to her children.
Right, Josie said. Pretty much.
Now the gray-haired woman opened her eyes. Josie caught her looking at Paul, as if assessing if he had the strength to live through all this. Cloudy step-aunt and godmother, tipsy mother. Josie bought sweaters and hats for Paul and Anna, showing the woman her competence and love by spending $210 on bright Bolivian clothing that her children would wear only reluctantly. Josie did some math and realized she had spent all of the money she'd brought, $310, in an hour, while in a state of being most would consider intoxicated. Across the street, she could see the chateau beckoning, warm and still.
Who wants to watch Tomasi Jerry? She asked.
They went back to the RV. The kids settled into the breakfast nook, and she started the movie. Josie crawled upstairs, fully clothed, lay down on the sunny mattress. Before she fell asleep, she heard Paul say to Anna, "Are you going to get your coloring book? I don't know how long you can play with a carrot." Were they watching the movie or not? How did it matter? She drifted off and woke up an hour later, sweating heavily. She looked down to find Paul and Anna asleep with their headphones on, hair matted. She closed her eyes again, feeling the heat of the afternoon, thinking that what she had done, taking the kids up here, notifying no one, especially not Carl, might be considered criminal. Was it illegal? Insane? Carl would use that word. For Carl, good things were insane, bad things were insane, Josie was insane. "You grew up next to a nut house," he would say, as if that meant something, as if the entire town where Josie had been raised would have been deranged by osmosis. As if Josie growing up near the Rosemont Veterans Administration Hospital, formerly the Soldiers' Home, better known as Candyland, would explain whatever he hoped it would explain. He thought her childhood, her proximity to the scandal, her emancipation from her parents at 17, gave him some kind of leverage. He was from sturdier stock, went the implied logic. So he was entitled to drift, was allowed to do nothing. This was nonsense, of course. His father was part of a beef conglomerate that deforested some large swath of Costa Rica to make room for cows and grass, cows that would eventually be chopped into American steaks. That's why he grew up in some luxurious expat school in San Jose, Costa Rica's, not California's, and why he'd grown up with servants, and why he had no idea how to work, what work meant. And because he'd never seen any connection between work and the ability to pay mortgages and the like, he felt at will to judge Josie's every quirk. And because Josie had been born to two nurses, an occupation Carl associated with the servant class he'd exploited as a child, and because both of them were implicated in the Candyland scandal, any variance in her behavior, any flaw or weakness could be exploited, tied to this VA tragedy. When she and Carl were together, they'd decided not to tell the kids anything about Candyland. But now, as she lay in the chateau, soaked in sweat, breathing the stale air inches from the ceiling, she knew she would have to be on guard around Sam. Sam, she knew, had told her twins about it all, Sunny and her own emancipation, and would be determined to bring it up in front of Paul and Anna. Josie's parents had been nurses at a hospital. She could tell her kids that. She had told them this. This was enough for now. At Anna's age, that was all Josie knew. Her parents wore white when they went to work at Rosemont and came home together, changed out of their whites, and said nothing about their day. Josie's knowledge of their work came in stages. When she was 7, she realized their hospital was for veterans. When she was 9, there were the musicals at home, and she became aware of Vietnam and that most of Rosemont's patients had fought there. But she didn't know what ailed them. She pictured rows of beds of happy soldiers with sprained ankles and black eyes. She didn't know as a child where it was exactly, if the war was still on or not. Occasionally, her parents talked about the patients. There was a man who spent the days knocking the side of his head as if to free up some loose bolt. There was the man who, not wanting to disturb the perfection of the made bed, slept under it. "I hope your parents aren't part of that Candyland mess," one of Josie's teachers said this one day. Josie had never heard of any Candyland mess, but the news that year became inescapable, the suicides. Rosemont had been overprescribing their psych patients, and they were dying in alarming numbers. They slept 18 to 20 hours a day, and when they weren't drugged into a stupor, they were killing themselves at the rate of one every few months. Most of the suicides happened in the psych ward itself, a few after discharge, and all were horrible in their strange detail. A man of 32 using a bedsheet to hang himself from a doorknob, another drinking bleach, rupturing his lower intestine. A man of 33 throwing himself from the roof, landing on another patient's mother, breaking her neck, and then, realizing he was not dead, using a piece of broken glass to slice open his wrists and jugular there on the sidewalk. That was the one that opened Rosemont up to national scrutiny. The newspapers discovered the place had a nickname among the vets, Candyland, and that macabre touch stoked public fascination. 18 suicides in 3 years, 5 accidental overdoses, maybe more. The faces of each young man, most of them in uniform, stared out from the paper each day. "We sent them to Nam to be killed," the editorials said. "When they came back alive, we killed them again." The head of the ward, Dr. Michael Flores, was arrested, and most of the blame fell on him. "I only wanted them to live without pain," he said. But Josie's home became loud. Her parents had been questioned, had been blamed privately and publicly. 4 of the suicides had happened on their watch, and the whispering grew. How could they have let it happen? Their colleagues at Rosemont stood by them, said they hadn't been negligent, but the doubts persisted and grew. The ward was closed. Then the hospital itself was closed, her parents were out of work, and Josie learned the meaning of the word complicity. Then, in what she saw as a teenager as a stunning display of irony, they both began abusing the very drugs, Dilaudid and Thorazine and Dilantin, that Flores had overprescribed. Just after her 14th birthday, her father moved out, and a year later moved to Cambodia, where he stayed and still lived. When Josie was 16, her mother was working as an in-home nurse for a family 50 miles away, caring for an elderly woman, Mrs. Harvey. "I'm in love, Jose," she said one day. She'd gotten involved with Mrs. Harvey's middle-aged son, another vet, another addict, and wanted Josie to come live with them in this new home with the dying woman and her son, making specious promises about their lives being good again. Josie thought, no, she had 2 years of high school left. She broke down one day at the dentist's office in the waiting room, and the receptionist had come to her, had brought her to the bathroom, had sat her down on the toilet, and dabbed her face with a warm, wet towel, and this had made Josie cry harder, louder, and soon she was lying in one of the examination chairs, face soaked with tears, and Dr. Kimura was next to her, initially thinking it was some body image breakdown. When the receptionist had caught Josie weeping, she had a People magazine on her lap, open to a story about heavy teenage girls being bullied. So she and Dr. Kimura thought Josie, who towered over both of them, was upset about her size, had been harassed at school. They brought her into a back room where surgeries were done, and they huddled around her like saints. There was something in Dr. Kimura's wet eyes and chandelier voice that invited Josie to talk. And when Dr. Kimura asked the receptionist to leave and told Josie she had the afternoon free, Josie told her everything. Her father was in Chiang Mai, and according to Josie's mother, lived with a paid harem of four women, one of them 13 years old. Her mother had been sleeping on the couch for 2 years. Now she was in love, but was using again, and was marrying an addict. There had been new people in the house. They were dealing. They weren't dealing. Josie didn't know. She remembered backpacks lined up in the foyer, always different backpacks, and the new men would arrive and leave with one of these backpacks. Josie began hiding in her room. Through Josie's ramblings, Dr. Kimura said very little, but her eyes seemed to have settled on something.
"Why don't you come here after school for a while? Tell your mom it's an apprenticeship," she said. "You need a calm place to be for a few hours every day."
The first week, Josie sat in the waiting room, doing her homework, feeling the thrill of betraying her mother in this small way. But she grew accustomed to the calm, to the simplicity, the predictability of the office. People came, went, paid, talked. There was no chaos, no screaming, no mother on the couch, no mother interacting with skittish men with hollow eyes. Sometimes Dr. Kimura brought her back to show her something interesting, an unusual x-ray, how the molds were made. But usually she spent those hours in Sunny's office, Dr. Kimura had told her to use her first name, doing her homework, sometimes napping, occasionally wondering about the photo of a teenager, a dishwater blonde girl who looked so unlike Sunny that Josie assumed it was a patient. After the last patient, Josie would help close up the office, and Sunny would ask for updates about happenings at home. Sunny listened, her eyes angry, but never said a disparaging word about Josie's mother. They were about the same age, Sunny and her mother, somewhere in the late 30s, but Sunny seemed a generation or two removed, far more settled and wise. One day, she closed the office door.
"I know this might be the last time I talk to you," she said, "because what I'm about to suggest will trigger a series of events that might get me in a world of trouble and might cost me my practice. But I think you should pursue emancipation from your parents, and if you do it, I'd like you to come to live with me. I know a lawyer."
The lawyer, a quiet but persistent woman named Helen, was a friend of Sunny's. They met the next day. She had a tight mound of curly hair and unblinking eyes. The two of them, Sunny and Helen, sat across from Josie, shoulder to shoulder. "We won't do this if there's any possibility of it getting ugly," Helen said.
"You already have enough drama in your life," Sunny added.
"If your mother objects," Helen began, but Sunny finished the thought.
"Then we can reassess. What do you think?"
Their eagerness was both unnerving and infectious. Josie wanted to do it. She wanted to be around these sober, functioning, efficient women who made grand plans quickly.
"Okay,"
Josie said, utterly unsure.
"Good,"
Sunny said, and took Josie's hand. Come home and have some dinner with us tonight. I want to introduce you to someone. So Josie called home, told her mother the truth, that she was eating dinner with her dentist, and because her mother had lost all hold on propriety, she agreed, told her to be home by 10. Josie rode in the back seat, Sonny's car old but clean, Helen in the front seat, Josie feeling very much like they were in a getaway car, sure that the three of them would be thereafter best friends and an inseparable trio. She entered Sonny's house, walking between Sonny and Helen as if being protected, like a president or pope. Samantha! Sonny yelled, and a girl tromped down the stairs and stopped midway. She was the girl from the picture. So Josie was Helen and Sonny's second project. The realization knocked her back. Samantha had been taken in a year before, fleeing a mother who beat her and a trucker father who had photographed her in the shower. Samantha lived 40 miles away, and Helen had been alerted to her case by a high school counselor there. Samantha's emancipation process was quick. Now Samantha was homeschooled in some self-guided arrangement that Josie didn't immediately understand. She didn't understand, either, why Sonny hadn't told her about Samantha before the emancipation discussions had begun. I couldn't tell you about Samantha before we were sure, Sonny said. After dinner that night, Sonny had suggested a walk, and so, under a dark canopy of trees, she explained Samantha's situation. It's best if she keeps a low profile. We have the restraining order on her dad, but it's best not to risk it. You understand? Does the existence of Samantha change your mind about all this? It did. During the drive from Sonny's office to her home, Josie had believed Sonny was taking her in an act of bravery, of wild and even irresponsible courage. But it was more mechanical than that. She and Helen had a system. You coming to me after Sam was serendipity, Sonny said, trying to return the situation to something closer to a fairy tale. You two are only a year apart and could make each other stronger. Or we could drag each other into a succession of feral teenage dramas, Josie thought. I know it's awkward, Sonny said that night and often thereafter, but it's quiet here and safe. It was awkward. Josie and Samantha were put in the same room, meaning Samantha's room had been instantly halved and her personal space evaporated. What have those two sluts done now? She muttered to herself, while loudly moving her belongings around the room to make way for Josie's. She cooperated, seething, competitive one month, then aloof, prone to occasional eruptions. Josie stayed in her school, and they had different friends, so their contact was incidental and avoidable. Sam treated Josie like a freeloading drifter who had come in from the rain to share a room she'd paid for. Eventually, there was detente, and they revealed each other's weaknesses, only to have them exploited later. They were smart and angry girls who were not properly grateful to Sonny or Helen, who argued with their teachers, who flirted with each other's boyfriends, who stole or broke each other's things. But their home was sane and calm, and Josie's own emancipation was accomplished without resistance. I laid out the pros and cons for your mom, Helen said one day, and Sonny smiled. The implication was that they'd utterly overpowered Josie's mother. It gave Josie a twinge of guilt. Josie visited her mother every month for the next year, and their meetings, always at a highway Denny's situated between their two towns, were cordial and tense, and they talked mostly about how good it would be in a few years when all was settled, when whatever resentment had burned off between them and they could return to each other as adults and equals. Ha! There were some whispers about Sonny and Helen, just what they were up to, building some kind of cult, one lost teenager at a time. Were they lesbians? Were they lesbians starting a lesbian cult? But after Josie, there were no more strays, not that year at least. Eventually, Sonny's home became a known haven for young women fleeing calamity, and the power of Sunny's interest in Josie was diluted by all the girls who followed. Sunny knew it and worried Josie and Sam would feel neglected. "Don't worry," Josie told her. "Never worry." Chapter 6. In a flurry, Josie woke the kids, got them in their seatbelts, and drove up the spit and back to the Cliffside RV park to meet Sam. They were late, stupidly late. In 20 minutes, Josie was putting on their shoes in the parking lot, Anna's like little rubber bricks, and then they were all standing atop the bluff, looking down at Sam, who was with about 20 others, a barbecue in full swing on the beach below, all to welcome Josie and her children. "Sorry," Josie yelled down as they made their way down the steep path, trying to smile, trying to laugh, as if they were all in this together, the Alaskan way, a life without schedules and set times for beach barbecues. "We fell asleep," Josie said brightly, trying to make it sound adorable, as Paul and Anna dragged groggily behind her, so she kept a smile frozen on her face as they jumped the last feet from the path to the beach. Sam was quickly upon her, swallowing her in a woolly embrace, her hair and sweater smelling of wood smoke. She was wearing shorts, boots with the laces open, and a hand-knit black sweater. Her hair was windblown and unwashed. "Don't worry, you're only an hour late to your own party," she said, releasing Josie and grabbing Anna and lifting her high. "You've never met me, but I plan to eat you," she said. And Anna's eyes went electric, as if alerted to another of her wild breed. Sam kissed Anna roughly on the ear while eyeing Paul more cautiously. "Is this Polly?" she said, and put Anna down. Paul faced her and seemed to be accepting the possibility that Sam would lift him too, but she didn't. She squatted in front of him and held his face with two red hands. "I always remember those eyes of yours," she said, and then stood up. The barbecue was being held close to the bluff on a vast beach at low tide, the beach striped in orphaned strands of ocean water, silver in the low light. Across the water were the Kenai Mountains, but no one paid them any attention. The rest of the guests were accustomed to all this rugged beauty, all this driftwood and all these round gray stones, the vast tree trunks hollowed by the sea and bleached in the sun. There were introductions to everyone assembled, a mix of scruffy people who worked for Sam, scruffy people who had worked for her in the past, parents of her twins' friends, and neighbors, most of whom wore down vests or wool sweaters, all of them in old boots. All along, one man seemed to be standing very close to Sam, and Josie guessed this was some kind of boyfriend. Josie tried to remember Sam's approach to marriage. She'd been at Sam's wedding to a commercial fisherman named JJ, but hadn't seen him since. Was it an open marriage? Something like that. This man in front of her, leaning into Sam with obvious familiarity, could have been 10, 15 years younger, but a thick, rust-colored beard made it hard to tell. Sam introduced him last. "This is Doug," she said, and held his hand up, high over her head, as if he'd just been declared the winner. No, it wasn't an open marriage. Now she remembered. JJ was away for months at a time, and they'd made an arrangement. Whatever happened while he was away on these trips didn't count. No questions could be asked, and he had only one request. No one she fooled around with could be anyone he knew. But here they were, among all of their mutual friends, and there was this man, Doug, who to all seeing humans was sleeping with her. "Do you still have kids?" Josie asked. "Or do they already have jobs at a cannery or something?" Sam raised her chin toward the shore. A few hundred yards toward the water, two silhouettes were standing before a large boulder. On the boulder was a giant bird, and Josie laughed to herself, figuring that any second she would be told that it was a bald eagle. "Bald eagle," said a man's voice, and she turned to find Doug holding a brown bottle of local beer out to her. "You guys want to go see Zoe and Becca?" Josie said, and gave Paul an imploring look. Go say hi and come back to eat. Paul took Anna by the hand and walked toward the water. Josie had a surging feeling that Sam had made a good life for herself here. She had many friends, friends willing to come out to the beach on a weeknight to greet Josie and her children. You get lost? Sam asked. We got here at 4, set everything up, and everyone showed up at 5. We said 5, right? Josie tried to flare her nostrils. We knocked on the doors of a bunch of the RVs up there, Sam continued, but no one had seen you guys. It was fascinating, Josie thought, how little she knew what to expect from Sam. 5 years was a long time, and Sam, a shapeshifter to begin with, might have changed into some entirely new entity by now. But she was still a keeper of grudges. Josie explained that they had been driving all day, and that they were off schedule, napping at odd times, that she didn't have a phone, and thus didn't have an alarm clock. And anyway, so what? It's summer, and Sam was among friends anyway, so who cares if she was late? Does anyone really care anyway? Ha ha. At the end of her soliloquy, Josie saw that Sam was looking at her in a certain way, her eyes searching and her mouth amused, and she remembered that Sam had often done this, had presumed she had a direct line into Josie's elemental soul, could get messages no one else could receive or decipher. Don't do that, Josie said. Don't act like you know me so well. I haven't seen you in 5 years. This delighted Sam even more. Her eyes opened like cartoon headlights. You left your practice and fled Carl. Or fled your practice and left Carl. That's what I heard. The only person she could have heard any of this from would have been Sunny, who was anguished over the loss of Josie's practice and who would never have put it in such terms. But Sam had always been flippant about any loss, any tragedy. She felt it her right as a survivor of a broken personal world. Well, Josie said, and couldn't conjure a way to finish the thought. She hoped the one word would suffice. In the stretch of Josie's silence, Sam only grew more delighted. Well, indeed, she said, as if they were engaged in some cute verbal dance they both knew and loved. My kids should eat, Josie said, hoping to focus herself and Sam on practical matters. Doug's on it, Sam said, nodding toward a bonfire, which Josie realized was also the barbecue. This was a barbarian arrangement, a vast open fire being fed with giant logs, and over it a grill held high by a complicated latticework of sticks. They like bratwurst? Doug asked. Josie said they did, knowing she would have to cut them into tiny pieces and tell her children they were hot dogs. Paul and Anna returned with the twins, 13 years old, identical, willowy, and athletic, taller than their mother or Josie. Their hair was strawberry blonde and thick, and with their light freckles and their eyes dark and bright and intense and laughing, they had the look of medieval warrior women just back from joyous plundering and man-beating and whale-riding. They strode to Josie and hugged her as if they really knew and loved her. Josie, overcome, told them they were beautiful, that she couldn't believe it, and they each looked directly at her, actually listening. They were not quite of this world. They took their leave, throwing sticks that the many large dogs could chase, and Josie gave her children plates piled with fragments of bratwurst and corn grilled in foil. Her kids sat on an enormous log next to a line of boys, all of whom were 9 or 10 years old, and each of whom was holding his own carving knife. As Paul and Anna ate, the boys whittled, their fists white, their long hair covering their eyes. Paul was watching passively, but Anna was enthralled. Josie knew she would want a knife and would talk about nothing but knives for days. You look tired, Sam said. You're sunburned, Josie said. That your boyfriend? She indicated Doug, who was dodging the changing direction of the bonfire's smoke. Sam shrugged and went to Doug, rubbing his back and then ducking from the smoke as it enveloped her. Josie glanced over to see that Anna had repositioned herself. She was now sitting on the sand in front of the child carvers, her eyes at blade level. The boys were laughing, thinking Anna was a trip, that this girl was the craziest thing they'd ever seen. Then Anna's eyes lit on an idea, and she lifted her sweater, the Bolivian one, all that heavy wool woven loosely, pulled it over her head with great effort to reveal a Green Lantern shirt underneath. She was showing the boys that she was no girl, no simple girl, that she was like them, that she liked Green Lantern, that she appreciated fighting evil with great supernatural force, appreciated the cutting of wood with big knives. The boys didn't care enough, though. They glanced, chuckled, but said nothing. Anna was not dissuaded. Shivering in her Green Lantern shirt, the temperature was dropping into the 50s. She squeezed in next to them on the log, every so often putting her hand on one boy's forearm as if to participate somehow in the carving, as if through this human transference she could be carving too. Josie served her a second brat on a paper plate, and Anna devoured it, never taking her eyes off the boys and their knives. Paul, meanwhile, took his plate and walked to the twins near the eagle and the boulder on the beach. Josie watched as he made his way directly to them and then stopped short. The girls turned toward him and seemed to acknowledge his presence in some satisfactory way. He squatted on the beach and ate his food, and the three of them looked at the eagle, and a pair of horseback riders trotted slowly across the horizon in the shallow water, until one of the girls threw a rock close to the bird, and it lifted off, its shoulders seeming tired, the movement of its wings far too slow and labored to create flight. But then it was up, rising like it was nothing. Flight was nothing. The planet was nothing. Nothing at all. Just another place to leave.
Chapter 7. After the barbecue, the kids climbed into the back of Sam's pickup, with Sam and Josie in front, and they drove back to Sam's house, passing young pines all the way, about a mile up a hill of tidy homes. The house, with a rolling lawn and orderly rows of shrubs surrounding it, had a clear view of the rest of Homer below. This was not some deep country log cabin. This was a respectable and modern house, newly painted and sturdy and clean. To be a bird-watching guide in Homer. Wow, Sam had it right. She had gone up to Alaska and opened her bird-watching operation, no fuss, didn't ask anyone's permission. She had the run of the forest, some island off of Homer, and she had it figured out. Had she left society, as Josie wanted to? Yes and no. She ran a business. She had kids. The kids went to school. She paid taxes. She sent emails. She was as trapped as Josie was. But she had a boat and wore boots, and her daughters were these holy outdoor creatures with long, flowing sweet corn hair. She'd figured out a few things. She'd simplified. Paul and Anna got changed and went upstairs, following the twins, and the twins said they would put them to bed. Anna was thrilled, Paul cautiously ecstatic. Josie had planned to tell Paul about Sam being his actual godmother, or announce this to Sam, but now she wasn't sure. She hoped Paul had forgotten. "I have a surprise," Sam said. She'd been making her own whiskey and wanted Josie to try it. Josie had never developed an appreciation for brown liquor and was fairly sure Sam's would not be good. Sam brought out a medieval bottle and poured anyway, and poured too much, and worse, she poured it into a coffee cup. Josie smelled it, and the stench was stronger than regular whiskey. It was wicked and fathomless, a predatory smell. Josie feigned sipping it, pretended to grimace, pretended to swallow and enjoy it in the brave, rugged way Sam expected. "Damn," Josie said. Sam was pleased. The purpose of the whiskey maker, it seemed, was to make the drinker gag. So good, Josie said. She hadn't tasted it yet. They took their cups out to the back deck. Sam grabbed a heavy blanket and turned on a propane heater and brought it close. The night was cooling and the sky was gray with low cloud cover. They sat with their feet touching, their bodies making a V facing the dark trees. Josie assumed deep talking was about to happen, and so took a long pull on the whiskey, wanting its effects without experiencing its taste. But the taste was inescapable and wretched. It burned. She thought of tennis shoes on fire. This is awful, she said. Sam smiled and refilled her cup. So what the fuck are you doing up here? Sam asked. Josie laughed. Sam laughed. They laughed loudly, so loudly that an upstairs window opened and one of the twins, Josie couldn't tell which, leaned down and her dark face said, Quiet out there, missies. It's bedtime for the little ones. The window closed and Sam turned to Josie. So Carl didn't want to come? She was kidding. Seriously, are you in touch with him? He in the picture? Josie gave Sam an accounting of his participation in his children's lives, which took 8 or 9 seconds. Too bad, Sam said. Remember when he nicknamed Anna, Oh No, and then My Bad? He was funny. Actually pretty good with kids. Both of these things had been true to some people at some point, but somehow his disappearance made him seem, to Josie at least, both less funny and less child-friendly. Whenever she heard Carl praised, she conjured his comical crimes. He had, more than once, asked Josie to fake an orgasm. She was ready to present this to Sam, but Sam was moving on. And did I hear right that you sold your practice? You're not a dentist anymore? And wasn't your face numb for a year or something? You're not planning on driving that RV off a cliff, are you? Stop me if I'm prying. No, Josie said. She couldn't think of anything else to say. She thought, you, who fled to Alaska and is somehow married but not married, you're judging me? But chose not to. There was no point. Josie took another long sip of the sickening whiskey and felt she could just let the night pass over her, an hour until she could claim exhaustion and go to sleep. The night air was warm, and the crickets or frogs were making their noise, and there was a breeze, and far off, some road hummed a forgettable tune. Sam topped off Josie's cup. So you quit? You sold the practice? What did Sonny say about that? Sam asked, and Josie was glad that Sam had stopped calling Sonny Mom. The last time she'd seen Sam, she was using that word, Mom. Neither she nor Sam had called Sonny by that name when they lived with her, and hearing her use it 20 years later, or whenever it was jarring, as if Sam had assessed what Sonny had been to her and had given it a name. Hadn't she once called her Sunzy? She had. Sam liked names, nicknames. These names did what? They helped Sam define or redefine what she and Sonny were to each other. They gave her some control, as if to call her Sunzy put her in her place as a small and aging woman, whereas Mom had been a holy honorific. But now she was Sunny again. Sunny was just her name, the name as they'd known her. Let's settle on something and leave it alone, Josie wanted to say. She sipped her whiskey, looked into the obsidian sky. This could be the cause of all modern neurosis, she thought. The fact that we have no immovable identity, no hard facts, that everything we know as foundational truth is subject to change. The world is running out of water. No, actually, there is enough water underground to cover the surface of the earth 600 feet deep. So there's no water problem? Well, only 6% of that underground water is drinkable. So we're doomed? Well, the hedging and backtracking never ended. The scientists, the astronomers being the worst offenders. We are matter. No, we are surrounded by matter. There are 9 planets. No, 8. We are exceptional. Our planet singular in its ability to sustain life. No, there are billions of Earth-like planets, most of them bigger than ours, most of them likely to be far better developed. Sonny, Sunzy, Mom. Sam was saying something. Josie focused on the words. She must have been devastated. Devastated! Oh, this. Josie had expected this. When she'd taken up dentistry in college, Sam was cruel. You don't have to suck up like that, Jose. That Josie had gone through with it and had opened her own practice. Sam had been livid, paralyzed. Then she'd moved up to Anchorage, then Homer, and there was an unspoken theory among Sonny, Josie, and Helen that Sam had chosen Alaska as her way of ceding victory and territory to Josie. Josie had won.